Welcome, dear listener, to the Castorbis Doctor Who podcast. My name is Christian Corley, and with me this week is James McLean. We're going to be having a chat in this show about recent developments in the production of Doctor Who Series 14. This is the era which we could probably call RTD2, although that sounds a bit like a droid from Star Wars, doesn't it? Yeah, we'll have to find out a better name for it than that. So we'll be chatting about various things that have occurred over the past few weeks with regard to the new Russell T Davies era of the show, which happens post-Chris Chibnall, post-Jodie Whittaker. Joining me this week is James McLean. Hi, James. James, I can't hear you.
Skype has a massive lag issue, so whenever I press it, it assumes I've already pressed it off. It comes to like...
How are you?
Time differential thing where it assumes that I'm actually... I don't know. I don't get it. This app is just so bad now.
Yeah.
I'm kind of embarrassed that we've just admitted that we still use it, which again,
I can
shows
cut,
the age.
I could cut it out or we could just leave it in for the charm. Your comments, I noticed your observation about Marvin the Paranoid Android was retweeted by Tariq Latif on Twitter. I think Tariq is our listener. So hi, listener. He quite liked your observation of Marvin the Paranoid Android's visual design in the last podcast, or the last but one podcast, one of the two, and he kind of cropped it and retweeted it, which was nice.
Ah, sweet. I mean, it was a great design, though.
Yeah, it was.
It still bowls me over. It's probably one of the most understated. It's just not talked about. And I think it's one of the most brilliant BBC designs ever because it's just so simple yet so... a multi-million dollar movie couldn't better it.
No, it couldn't, no. I mean, it sounds like we're angling for another retweet here, but we're not. We are here.
No, absolutely not. Well, I mean, if you want to, that's... I couldn't care less who is tweeted. But, I take the compliment and it's really nice to know that other people agree that it's... Yeah. It was a fantastic design that just isn't acknowledged.
I think that's fair to say. So, James, do you know what's going on with Doctor Who Series 14?
I do. Well, I know the rumours as they stand.
Okay. Maybe we'll come to those later. There's a few things that have transpired over the past few days and weeks concerning this new era of Doctor Who that is in development. And again, as with other transitions, the old show, as it is, still hasn't completed. Yeah, we've still got two more episodes of the Jodie Whittaker Doctor to get through. That sounds like it's a bit of a chore to enjoy. So there's, as mentioned, there's a few things we weren't going to talk about. The main thing I'm going to leave for a moment, because it's kind of really important. There's a lot to talk about, I think, about that. But first of all, Phil Collinson is back as day-to-day producer. He was the show's producer from 2005 through to 2008, and he's the day-to-day runner of the show, basically. Eagle-eyed fans spotted Doctor Who Series 14 on Collinson's online CV at Independent Talent, which lists Doctor Who as currently in development. Collinson's worked with Davies repeatedly over the years. He obviously had a time on Coronation Street, which a lot of people know about and will remember. And more recently, he's worked with Davies again on It's a Sin. Phil Collinson's always seemed like a kind of a steady hand, didn't he?
Yes. So I think it's interesting that this is all presumably been decided very much on the production company side. There was a lot of people, when Davies was announced, was saying, yeah, this is the BBC desperately trying to regain its past glories with Doctor Who. And it's like, well... kind of feels like a production team which knew how it worked well, gathering people that it worked well with.
Yeah.
And Collinson, one of them.
Just to extend on what you say there, I always get, or I have been getting the impression as well, that what it is a production company pitching to the BBC, this is what's happening in, this genre of TV around the world, and you're still doing this, let's do it more like this.
Could be, couldn't it? Who knows? But I don't think it's any coincidence that the production company is including Davis included in that, and now Collinson, that this is very much on their end rather than the BBC's end. And I don't doubt that the BBC does harken back to past glories and wants to see that. But I feel that this is actually less to do with that, and it's more to do with the production company drawing on people it trusts and knows that it can deliver.
So,
Which will be interesting, because as I said before in previous podcasts, I have no doubt they're not going to do the same, which is a very interesting thing in the question of productions and how people, funnily enough, perceive how production works. That you're not bringing the same artist to replicate something. You're bringing in a set of artists you trust to be tools to retranslate, I guess, and that's what it is. Do you know what I mean? It's not about trying to create the same thing as done before, but using those tools to create something new. And I think that's kind of interesting. We don't really talk a lot about that.
No, we haven't really. I guess
Well, I mean, you
there
think of
isn't an awful lot of context for it, is
film.
there?
Because with film, you'll say, well, you'll see certain, those big auteur names will tend to carry on their same production people with them. So, we talk about think people like obviously Hitchcock and I think Kubrick. But it's interesting when you get that where they're actually being used for their ability to redraft something into something fresh rather than to carry on the same vision as in film the director enjoyed or felt worked with his work. So it'll be interesting to see how that functions, how radically different it will feel, or whether it will feel very similar, but done in a different way, or done in different avenues, different streams. I don't know. But yeah, I'm kind of interested to see where this will all go.
Orson Welles did that as well, only he went an extra step and also used the same actors.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the critiques against people naming famous directors. For style, this is a lot of these famous directors carried the same crews, who would be the same cinematographers, who would recreate their signature looks. And it's like, how much can we really be talking about Hitchcock film without talking about the cinematographer? As you say, the casts were often replicated in some of these big names. Even in modern day, you look at Tim Burton films, certain people pop up. So yeah, I think it's an interesting question of like how will these roles, and I think a lot of this is about production flow. I think it's less about vision. So, especially when we're talking about producers more than say who will be brought on as director, who will be brought on as writers. It's about how do we have a really tight-knit production or series of productions for all we know. That can be managed effectively. And to do that, we need people we can trust. Because if we go out and get people we don't know, and this is going to have to be very tightly held together. And I think this is the other reason. This is the Doctor Who is something which has a lot of scrutiny, as you've just noted, in how people worked out that Collison was involved, and media scrutiny as well. And we've seen in the past that because it's a big thing to be dealing with, it can often cause lots of hiccups, be lots of problems. It's a complicated show to write for because you're playing with multi-genres, serialization, yet at the same time you're dealing with sort of standalone stories. There's a lot of things to go wrong. You need to have a production team which is tight, and then in the past where it hasn't been tight in various ways, that's where problems have occurred. So I think this is about sewing up the show into something, or the franchise into something which is manageable. And maybe even using those people who did it before to learn from the mistakes made in the past, whatever they may be, to ensure it works and flows even better now. So yeah, kind of interesting.
That episode of Doctor Who with the bus,
Planet of the Dead.
Planet of the Dead. I'm pretty sure Phil Collinson wasn't producing Doctor Who in that year. And Planet of the Dead was a bit of a disaster, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, wasn't it? With the bus on.
The bus got damaged, and then they filmed it in a country overseas whose name escapes me at the moment. But a lot of the footage they weren't able to use, so then they had to remount it in Cardiff. with a lot of green and blue screens and all that sort of thing going on, which kind of made the
No,
whole thing a
it was,
bit.
I was going to say it was produced by Tracy Simpson.
That's right, yeah. And yeah, it's I always felt at the time, I remember writing in Castorbis, the old Castorbis, that it just seemed a little bit ostentatious to take a London bus to the Middle East to film in a desert and
To
then
do
bring it.
bar.
Yeah. And then basically they didn't use it in the end anyway. The whole thing just seemed like this is going to go wrong from the very beginning. And I mean, not pointing fingers at anyone, but you kind of get the feeling that Phil Collinson would have looked at that and thought, that's a bad idea, we'll do it here.
Interesting. It's an interesting point. I think that season, as he's written, as Davis has written in the writer's tale, was a point where I think perhaps the whole production was hitting its burnout point. And I imagine many mistakes were made because of that, which were not down to, as you say, any specific person. Yeah, it's, yeah. Man, that's the kind of thing I think that bringing back a team which knows each other might be able to reflect upon and build upon more than if you bring a whole new set of voices together. So it could be acknowledging that this is a beast. The Doctor Who is a beast that needs people who understand it as much as they understand television. So I think that's why there's this very rigid beast being created
Yeah, quite
to
possibly.
handle the beast, I suppose.
Yes.
I'm going to carry on down this whole
Yeah, you just want to talk
beast
about the
plot.
beast, do you? Okay, right. We'll move on from the beast and Phil Collinson, Phil the Beast Collinson, as we're now going to be referring to him, to the 13th Doctor's regeneration, which this isn't the first time this suggestion has come along. There might not actually be a regeneration, or if there is a regeneration, there's not another face involved in the regeneration. It might just start completely cold, as per Rose back in 2005. Director Jamie Magnus Stone has the honour, or has had the honour, of directing Jodie Whittaker's final episode, and told the Radio Times basically her last day of filming was most of the crew's last day of filming as well. So it was all orchestrated to have this big final last day, and we shot that last day for Jodie in story order, so we ended up on her last scene. But before that, there were so many tears. Now we know that that regeneration is on location, not in the TARDIS, which hasn't happened since 2005, other than when the Eighth Doctor turned into the War Doctor. But there is this. There's been no mention of another actor being involved. Having said that, we know that, because we know from watching Doctor Who and from reading books such as The Writer's Tale, that David Tennant and Christopher Eccleston weren't on set together when the Ninth Doctor regenerated and the Tenth Doctor. There were several months between those events taking place. So this isn't completely unusual, although to do it on location perhaps is. What do you think, James? Do you think this is something they're going to patch in later, or is it a cold start for the 14th Doctor?
I don't know, or is it? Yeah, is it, or I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, these are again media moments, aren't they? So it could be trying to keep things vague to create engagement. It could be, as you say, a nice cold end. If you're looking at, if Davis is looking at a soft reboot so far as tone and production approach, it could be a way of creating that line. And then opening again under Davis, it could be that there could be an ideology that dropping in a doctor at the back end of the story, what does it give you? Does it draw people in to see the next episode? Does it create unfair expectations? Is it messy? I think it kind of is. Now, I can't. In fact, all the regeneration since 2005. Bar maybe the first one, have all been a fairly messy affair. And I'm talking about this kind of flow from end of era to new era. So you get the feel at the end of time to the opening of 11th Hour tonally is utterly different. and actually feels kind of messy. The end of time is obviously quite energetic still. It's quite vibrant, but the way the music plays, the Doctor almost falling out of his TARDIS, the tone is very much about Moffat putting his signature energy into that show, and it doesn't quite match with the way End of Time ends. You can look at Smith to Capaldi. Smith, you have this quite shocking, angry ending with the Capaldi, and when it starts again in the next episode, and they've been through time, they come out of a dinosaur's mouth. Again, it feels very separated from outro. And again, with the movement to Chibnall's era, the whole sort of falling out of the TARDIS to the way that she lands in the TARDIS, there's a sort of transitional thing which doesn't always work very well. I mean, it can be good in the sense that it gives the new person a real feeling like this is my new vibe. But I kind of, they never really feel very synchronized. And it's probably been a while since they have. Probably the last time it has is probably Legopolis to Castrovalva in my head, where you have quite a nice flow between the two, even though there's obviously some shifts in terms of in how they filmed it, in terms of where they filmed it and everything. But this, I kind of see a logic in sort of going, no, we end on Jodie, we start a new era with a brand new face. That itself is going to draw people in because they'll have no clue what that person's like. Why do we need to do a transition? What does it really give? And I don't think often it gives much. But I think the only way it would give to me is, again, it's like Legopolis. And I think that is the best regeneration for that reason, because you do feel like it flows, that is part of a story. You know, it's essentially, as we've seen in the box sets, is part of a three-part trilogy, as a lot of people see it. And you feel it. In every other circumstance, it's jarring.
Yeah, I can't really disagree with any of that. I
I mean, it can be fun to be jarring sometimes, can't it? I mean, it can be fun to sort of pull out expectations. But I can't say any of the regeneration since 2005, bar the Christmas Invasion, really felt like they were kind of honouring what was set up at the end. Even if the same writer set up the end, like Moffat obviously did, as I recall, did the last lines of Smith in End of Time, and he was allowed to do all that. But it doesn't feel anything like what you see in 11th Hour. There's just something very, very different about it, and I don't like it. I think there should be a little more of a flow. And maybe that's also to do with the fact that they keep breaking sort of style as well, don't they? I mean, you very rarely get a changeover of style. Perhaps the only one, I suppose, you did with Smith to Capaldi. They kept the same console room. Well, I suppose they did with Eccleston and Tennant. The need to sort of revamp things always seems to be a bit odd. And it feels more like a production signature rather than actual signature that's keeping respectful to the story. Interesting. I hadn't really thought about it before. It's very rare that happens, isn't it? Because I mean, Troughton to Pertwee is utterly, well, I mean, that's, I suppose, exactly what they'd be doing here, to be fair. I mean, we talk about Eccleston to Tennant, but we've seen it with Pertwee to Troughton to Pertwee. But I mean, apart from that, you go into Pertwee to Baker. I mean, yes, it's in the same space. There is a certain feeling of transition, to give that bit of credit. But it does also kind of feel like a new era, and obviously units swept aside within that story. But there is that transition, I'll give it credit there.
And there's
I
time for
think
Sarah to
Legopolis
get hair extensions as
is
well.
there. So I still think I think I like the Legopolis to Castrovalva, because it kind of feels like, I think the problem is that for the production and the regeneration is a big deal. I kind of like it that for the Doctor's life, that sometimes this would happen in the middle of stuff and it can't afford to be a big deal. And I think that was really nice of Legopolis, is that they're trying to deal with him. Master's still out there. He hasn't quite won, and he's probably still trying to ponder what the hell he was trying to win anyway, but it doesn't matter. He's onto his next scheme. But he's still the threat. And yeah, they're having to deal with this on top of that. And it's the same threat that was in the previous story with Tom Baker. And it kind of adds a different texture and excitement to regeneration. So you're having to deal with this new person, but at the same time, the same threats are still around them. And they haven't really done that. And that surprised me, to be honest. And I don't know why that is. And obviously, when they do a changeover of showrunner, I can understand. But that would be kind of, I've always thought that would be kind of exciting. You know, that there's a changeover, but the story continues. You know, like Star Trek used to do, didn't they? They used to do like two-parters where the first part would be the end of the season, and then you'd have like 12 months before the next part starts. And in that period, they had no clue how they were going to end it. They'd have to write it from, you know, we never do that. And that could be kind of fun. But yeah, obviously, we're not doing that here.
Yeah, I don't
I
recall
feel
that from
like I'm
Star Trek, but
filibustering here for no reason, but.
well, maybe you are, but there's no other questions from the house. Let's move on. Right, we'll do this because this is actually quite an interesting point, and this will be like our final little chat, and then we're going to go and record another podcast for you, dear listener. Oh, sorry, we're going to record another podcast for you, Tariq. The classic Doctor Who website has apparently disappeared.
Oh.
It was first detected by Andrew Ellard. He tweeted that he's miserable to discover the BBC's once excellent classic Doctor Who site is now just a bunch of front pages that don't work, but also haven't been taken down. He's suggested you click links and see what happens, but it doesn't look good. It says at the top that the page has been archived, big fan, and is no longer updated, and then pretty much everything that you click just takes you through to a 404 not found or to the current Doctor Who website. Now, it's possible that it's all been decommissioned, and that wouldn't be an entire surprise, but given there's a 60th anniversary coming up next year for Doctor Who, so you would think that they you would think maybe there'd be an expectation that the BBC would have all the websites running correctly, just for anyone interested, press, interested in researching Doctor Who, that these pages might work correctly. As Ellard points out, there are Wikipedia links that you could refer to anyway, and they're possibly more detailed than what the BBC offers. But then again, the BBC offers original photography and scripts and production notes and things like that. So it is a shame. This isn't the first time this has happened with the BBC. They retired a big chunk of the old BBC Cult website many years ago, which Doctor Who was part of in those days before 2005 happened. And so this isn't the first time that they've done this, but I think there's been no announcement that this would happen. So it's a bit disappointing, isn't it?
Yeah, I wonder if a little bit is to do with changes in how people engage with the internet. I wonder how much people engage with written sources as much now. I mean, I'd suspect if it was taking, if it was taking heavy traffic, maybe it would still be there, but I suspect it wasn't. I mean, it could be that there's a whole new sort of planning procedure for when it moves into its new era, which will also include its digital presence, which would not entirely surprise me with Davis, but that stuff might be sort of just taken off and now be looking at being worked into a new way for a new era, probably perhaps a more concise way. Because I mean, it was quite a bloated thing, the classic. There's a lot of good stuff in there, but it was quite old style in the way it navigated. So maybe that's the case, you know, maybe not be the be all and end all, but yeah, it's one of those weird things, isn't it, that we get to a point where we start feeling like data is always going to be there, is always going to be present, and you know that we can store everything, everything can be archived, but you know everything is ephemeral, everything's going to degrade. You know, I've been to film archives where I can see that they are doing their best to put them into cold, you know, to put data into cold storage and, you know, try and maintain. But invariably, that's not ever going to, it's not going to over, you know, stuff's going to be selected, stuff's going to be lost. And that's just the sad thing about life, isn't it, I guess?
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that actually. I got a gadget here, which I think it's in here. which I haven't used yet. I was very excited to receive, and then I realized I didn't have one of the cables I needed for it. It's called a grease weasel. Basically, what it does, you connect it to your computer, then you connect an old-style floppy disk drive to it, and with the software, it will read the disk, but not the data from the disk, the actual magnetism, and then convert those magnetic fields into the data that is on the disk.
That's just pure sci-fi, isn't it?
It's mad! But I've got a few old Amiga disks and a handful of very old, well, not as old, Windows disks that I want to get data off that I wasn't able to previously. So that proved quite useful. It was only £20. I haven't used it yet though, so I don't know if it's going to work. But yeah, I think it backs up your point, because like old floppy disks and the old CDs and DVDs as well, to a different extent, because they
Yeah,
rot. Old floppy
absolutely.
disks just. Sorry, go on.
I mean, digital humanities have been struggling with this for a while. Is this sort of notion that all this work that we have, or is often, as you very well know from your work you do outside of this podcast, is quite often set within the conditions of the things which reads that data. So, when you've got like a Spectrum game, a PlayStation game, as examples of video games, you are struggle. How do you represent that material? And how does that, again, if you're looking to evoke history through experience, how do you work that material? I mean, for Spectrum stuff, do you need the loading screen to really feel the experience of playing a Spectrum game and what that was like? Same with a PlayStation game. Do you need the loading up screen? Do you need the package? What do you keep? What is vital to the experience of our media? And that's kind of hard. I mean, I find it funny. There was a tweet which was about Blake 7, and someone said, "I'm watching Blake 7 differently today," and it was a snapshot of the beginning VHS box set, which came out in about 1989, and it was, I know Christian will know this, was a compendium of the first four episodes, which had been heavily edited together into one film length
Yeah, it's massive.
story. And so they were watching it like that, and that in itself is a different experience, not just because it's a different edit of the first four episodes, but also because it's a different experience of the time sitting and watching, because it was the only way you could get the beginning Blake 7. So you'd watched it in that way, and that would become cemented as your way of understanding those episodes until a few years later when they started releasing them individually and as two episode VHS box sets. But at the time, that was how it was.
There was a version
Yep.
of The Godfather released like that, wasn't there? Godfather 2 and Godfather 1 all edited together, which was like an official cinematic release or a TV movie release in the States that was released over here. And I've been wondering recently whether the BBC Videos team were inspired by that in some way. It's interesting.
But then, as you say, these sort of memories of how we interacted with medium, as you say, do inspire how we play with them and how we do things now. I'm just trying to, like, I remember the recent iteration of Battlestar Galactica. Now, not good. There's another one coming, as far as I'm aware. But the recent, 2000s version, with its opening segments on its intro, it used to do a bit of the episode as part of the intro. And that was deliberately inspired from the Space 1999, how, as I recall Ron Moore saying, how they used to integrate that. I know it was done for a few shows at the time. It wasn't just Space 1999, did it? But certainly in the genre, it was a show which was very famous for intercutting bits of what was coming up in the episode into your intro title sequence. And when they truncated that, later on in the second season, they got told off by fans because they loved it. Because I think, again, it was exciting. It was a callback, and it's just a sad thing. I know we've sort of gone way beyond the BBC website, but I think it comes down to that question, isn't it? Is how important is this material? And it's not just the data, but it's like the memories of where the data was, what that data means to people, their engagement there with that website meant a lot to people. But we can't keep everything. But yeah, I mean, it was a great resource. And I'd be interested to see whether, when David comes back, whether he'll do the same again and look to expand Doctor Who more into those digital domains in a different way. Because obviously, as we say, how we consume digital stuff is very different now.
Yes. Well, I mean, on the other hand, all these production notes and all that sort of thing, there are kind of there's other resources, isn't there? There's Doctor Who magazine, there's the Black Archive series of books, there's all sorts of alternatives, I suppose. But and Wikipedia, and then you've got the Wayback Machine as well, if you wanted to sort of dig
I
out
was
a
going to
copy.
say you could archive, you could go through archive.org to the Wayback Machine and
Yeah.
pull data, but it is a shame when stuff gets kind of lost like this, though. The era of the 2000s, which most people listening who are foolish enough to be listening to this will remember, was a totally different era before, like, the 2.0 social media revolution of MySpace, Facebook, and the like, where websites were these repositories for archives of knowledge, rather than the sort of drip feed that you get through social media. The Making Blake 7 account on Twitter is great for its release of production material for each episode in schedule order. And they're doing some great stuff at the moment. But again, it's a tough thing, isn't it? How do you make it work? And I think what is kind of cool, though, is that, where you get things like that, and sort of like the stuff that Gareth Cavanagh does with Vault Vault, where you get fans who, in the end, are the real proper custodians of this data because it means something to them, who will actually compile sort of physical copies of this material, which, funnily enough, has probably got more longevity, if treated right, than a data storage, which will always have a has a threat to it, to its existence, because it's a permanent cost in keeping it running. Well, there is no cost really once you've got your magazine. And I think the Blake Sevens, stuff that's done there, it goes down the same route, compiling stuff in book forms. And that's kind of cool. So we're almost going back in time, aren't we?
We are, yeah. That's a different podcast entirely. Let's finish this week's show with Henry Wolfe, who sadly passed away at the age of 91. He played the Collector in The Sunmakers, that
Oh.
famous Robert Holmes satire on the UK's inland revenue tax collection system. It's a funny story, The Sunmakers, because it kind of balances some very sharp satirical points with some rather ridiculous scenes and over-the-top performances by other members of the cast. It's one of Kavanagh's favourites as well, I think. I've always liked it.
I've never liked it.
Yeah.
I do seem to sit on the opposite end of the spectrum to Cavanagh. He just has odd tastes. He has tastes that are permanently, well, no, that's not true. I was going to say are permanently frozen in the 70s and 80s, but I mean that is unrepresentational of Gareth. He's got, he's far more broader than that. But the love of that period, and again, I think a lot of it's a shame he's not here to talk about this, but I think a lot of that love comes to some degree, but not all, from memories of what that elicited in watching those things at the time, what they
Yeah.
meant, and the sort of way of watching things, the anticipation, how they sort of situated within the culture are very, very important to people like him and me as well. So I'm going to make sure this isn't a criticism because I totally get that. He just double downs on it more than I do. But the thought of the sort of little bit about coming up soon, Question of Sport, but now Blake Seven, those little moments that sort of surround things that we watched as well as so important, and the shows that surrounded them as well gaining importance just because of where they were and what they meant to that Saturday night viewing. It might not be the thing you were watching, but they were part of the anticipation or the outcome of watching something. And so they have more meaning.
That's why they keep
And yeah,
the
and
BBC,
maybe.
they put the continuity links on the BBC DVD extras, don't they?
Absolutely,
Yeah.
because they mean a lot to people. And I feel very, very awkward now because I feel like I've sort of assassinated him for this. If he can't, you one cannot like The Sunmakers, which of course you can. And there's some lots of interesting stuff in it, but I've only watched it once and have never had the urge to watch it again. It just found it quite pedestrian in a lot of its sort of in the pacing of it. But you need to really we need to get Gareth on so he can come and assassinate me.
Yeah.
No, let's rephrase that because in case he actually genuinely does, and that will dial up my anxiety. can come and sort of critique my perspectives and my opinions.
Either way, yeah. Henry Wolfe, after he did a lot of stuff during the 70s, then 1978 he moved to Canada, where he went on to win an award for his solo performance in Hancock's Last Half Hour, and took up an academic post and taught drama at the University of Saskatchewan from 83, becoming a professor in 1990, and was still directing and acting plays long after he retired in 1997. He is survived by his wife and four children. So yeah, he's
That's not
yeah, and
that
making
much.
a quite a memorable appearance on one show, appearing just the once as well. That's always useful. He's in other stuff. He was in the Ruttles, Rutland Weekend Television, beg pardon, and Steptoe and Son as well, occasionally. Other stuff. Yeah, good character actor.
I think that it's going to be the sad thing that I mean, one thing I've always loved about, and I'm going to go back to say like Gareth, watching some of his social media feeds, is there's all these little memories and these little moments of things from the 70s and 80s, which I'd forgotten about and go, oh my God, yeah, that. And I just wonder, in 20 years' time, given there's such a saturation of material and the way we watch things so individually rather than really in rather as at scheduled times, whether, how memories will be of those sort of periods is going to be quite different. I think
Probably
that's
is.
going to be really interesting.
We'll find
Yeah,
out in 20
because
years, won't we?
and now the Doctor beats his arch enemy, the Daleks, in another exciting adventure of, those sort of things. Well, I suppose they still do that, to be fair, on the BBC. They do that, but
You don't get it
I
on
don't know.
iPlayer, though, do you?
No, you don't. Well, that's it. And the way we consume culture and what it means to us has changed. And I think that's interesting. And I just wonder what Gareth Cabana 2.0, in 20 years' time, what he will be reflecting, or 30 years' time, sorry, Gareth, 40 years' time even, will be reflecting on the times of this age.
We're making the booking now.
Yes.
I was updating some of the old podcasts earlier on, so they're on Audio Boom and on iTunes and everything. And it was one from 2011. I thought they were all uploaded, but this one wasn't. Of us discussing closing time 11 years ago. Well,
God,
t 10 and a half years ago, but even so. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's Doctor Who podcast from Casterbus. We'll be back again with more chat of time travel proportions next time. Until then, it's goodbye.